Well, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, a published report about radiation from an earthquake, they say, may be responsible for the mysterious Shroud of Turin image that many believe to be the depiction of Jesus Christ. We're going to get into that, of course. It's an incredible story. Barry Schwartz, of course, author of The Turin Shroud, will be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Over the next couple hours, we are going to be talking about one of, and there are many on this planet, great mysteries, the Shroud of Turin. Is it real? Well, scientists are claiming that the Shroud very well could be real. There was an earthquake in Jerusalem around 33 AD after the crucifixion, and they say it could have caused radioactive reaction and confused dating techniques. Let me talk about Barry Schwartz for a moment. He's the official documenting photographer of the Shroud of Turin Research Project. He's going to explain that to you. He has been on the program before, co-author of Turin Shroud, the Illustrated Evidence. Barry, welcome back. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure, George. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, hard to believe we're getting close to Easter again. My gosh. Slow it down.
Every year.
Oh, my gosh, it really does. Can you explain, first of all, Barry, and then we're going to get into your work, what this story means, this Shroud of Turin story and this earthquake story that came out a few weeks ago?
Well, George, you know, I hate to disappoint anyone, I'm thrilled whenever something positive about the Shroud of Turin is in the media, because, as you know, often what's in the media is less than positive. So that part of it's good. The frustration with this particular article is it's got a number of problems with it. Number one, their dating of the earthquake, according to a geologist who has been in touch with me about this article, this man has done core samples and has been studying in the Dead Sea for several decades. The earthquake that did take place couldn't have been of the magnitude these gentlemen claim.
Yeah, they said it was an 8.2, right?
Yeah, and it's the biggest earthquake documented based on sediments in the Dead Sea from core samples that were taken. Turns out that about the biggest magnitude that could have happened might have been about a 6.2 to a 6.5. The other thing is it probably wasn't in 33 AD, but perhaps 26 AD, and it happened in Turkey, so the effect in the Jerusalem area would have been
minimal.
And the other thing is, of course, they're talking about the fact that a severe earthquake releases a certain type of radiation. And that's an interesting theory. It's been proposed many times before for the Shroud, both as something that perhaps created the image and as something that might have impacted the cloth in a way that would have skewed the radiocarbon dating that was done in 1988. Unfortunately, there's a lot of scientific evidence presented by someone who is a great expert on the effects of radiation. That's my old friend Ray Rogers, may he rest in peace, who was a research chemist at Los Alamos National Laboratories for 30 years. And he wrote a paper, which we published on our website, shroud.com, that deals with radiation effects. And what Rogers did was he took actual flax samples. Shroud is made of linen, which is from a flax plant. Mm-hmm. And he took some flax samples, including some actual fibers of the Shroud of Turin, and he had them irradiated over at the lab there to see what impact radiation would have on the fibers. The Shroud fibers, the image fibers, don't have any damage to the fiber itself, but radiation would cause such damage that could be detected by polarized light microscopy and other methods. Rogers evaluated the samples and compared them to irradiated samples, and there's no indication of any radiation impact on the fibers of the Shroud, the actual Shroud fibers, other than the gamma radiation that we're all receiving as we sit and speak right now. So it doesn't appear, you know, it's great to say, it's like saying the Shroud's a painting. You can say that, but there's no paint. So it's pretty hard for it to be a painting. So the same kind of thing applies here. It's great to say that radiation made it, but there's no real evidence that that's the case. And with the other flaws in their theory regarding the earthquake, at least according to the geologist who wrote to me when the story broke, and actually we're going to be publishing some of his work in our next update probably in May. so that we can present people with not something to just challenge the work of these researchers, because this archaeologist or this geologist has actually been in touch with the researchers over the last 2 days. So so they're going to try and work it out. And look, I don't want to be critical of their work. I'm just saying that this isn't new. The theory about radiation has been proposed countless number of times over the last few decades. And so we're going to have to wait and see. But I wouldn't put a lot of weight on this as anything more than another group of researchers trying to come up with some explanation for what obviously is something that hasn't been very well explained over the years in light of all the research that we've done and all the chemistry and physics and spectral data and all the other things have been done. We still aren't that any real closer to an answer of how this image formed, although we do have other reasons why the radiocarbon dating might be skewed, and that is the fact that the same man I mentioned before, Ray Rogers, published a paper in 2005 just before his death in a very sophisticated peer-reviewed journal pointing out that the sample site that was chosen for carbon dating, the shroud, was actually anomalous, did not represent the main body of the cloth. It had cotton interwoven. It had been dyed. Somebody had repaired that area very carefully, properly done, with a very special way of reweaving, and then tried to dye it to match the color of the original cloth. He was able to show that and prove that scientifically. So we have a better explanation, I think, there for what skewed the carbon dating than some earthquake emitting some radiation that skewed, you know, that modified the cloth in some manner. There's really nothing to support that theory. So
in spite of this report, you're still a believer the shroud is authentic, and tell me why.
Well, George, you know, people ask me that question all the time. I believe you've even asked me that in the past. There isn't one piece of evidence that's the most convincing. It's really an accumulation of a massive amount of data. And, you know, there's a little bit of data that points away from the authenticity of the shroud, but I would say that there's 10 times more data pointing in the other direction. And as we've discussed in the past, I didn't rush into this. I didn't even want to be on that team. I said no when they first asked me. I tried to quit a couple times. Yep. Being Jewish, I didn't feel this was something I wanted to necessarily get involved with. But the properties of the image, being as unique as they are, did catch my attention, and that's why I stayed on the team. But the point simply is this. I didn't accept the shroud as authentic until 17 years after our team came to an end. So it took me 20 years, basically, from the days that I held that cloth in my hand until 1995 or so, when I finally came to believe the shroud was authentic, based mostly on the scientific and historic evidence, and not on, you know, either my spiritual beliefs or religious beliefs, but simply because the evidence is truly overwhelming. When you cut through all the kind of nonsense that we hear about in the media and get to the real science, that's what convinced me.
Well, it's an incredible story. It always has been. The image that you have photographed over the years, Barry, incredible indeed. Tell us what it was like, that very first experience when you saw the shroud.
Well, you know, we had arrived in Turin about a week in advance. Our equipment had been shipped in 80 crates ahead of us. We arrived a week early so we could unpack everything and get it set up and then start our examination. Problem was, we had an X-ray machine with us, and on the crate on the outside was a radiation sticker. And the Italian customs officials took one look and seized all the equipment and wouldn't release it to us for 5 days. So by the time we got the equipment, we were down to a day and a half before the shroud was to be brought to us. And so by the time the shroud was brought in the room, we had been working nonstop, literally around the clock, just to be ready for it. And I think that first couple of hours, we were so intent on this. Remember, we'd spent 17 or 18 months planning for this before we ever went to Italy. So I think a lot of us just had to suspend our personal feelings. And I can say that it was kind of like it was almost dreamlike. After all the almost 2 years of planning this, there I was standing in front of this piece of cloth, the piece of cloth that I had stupidly publicly said, give me 5 minutes and we'll take a look and we'll see the paint and come home.
Yeah.
I've regretted those words for about 36 years. But, you know, because it took about 15 minutes after being in the room with it and looking, examining it close up with a, you know, magnifier and looking for any sign of any paints or pigments. And it only took 10 or 15 minutes to realize there was nothing like that there. So when we were first given that, you know, that piece of cloth, we had so much, we had a 5-day test plan, and it was filled every minute of each of those days. So we had so much work to do. And I think it wasn't until a day or two into it where we sort of settled into what we were doing that people began to more or less reflect on it. Now, I can only speak for myself, remembering that I'm not a Christian. I didn't have any emotional attachment to the subject matter. If anything, I was quite skeptical of it. So for me, I didn't have any great emotion, other than I think all of us understood at that moment that we were doing something of an historic nature. We understood that. I don't think we understood just how important it was at the time. It takes some time for history to become history and the value or importance of what you've done to become apparent. And I think over the, you know, the ensuing years is when it really came clear to a lot of us just how significant our work had become. But at that moment in time, I think most of us had sort of suspended that. I know a few of the guys who were good Catholics or good Christians probably experienced more of an emotional feeling at the time than maybe I did. But I was there to do, you know, to do science and didn't have that attachment to the subject matter that others might have. A few of our guys on our team were, you know, devout in their faith, but many were, there were three Jewish guys, there was a Mormon, there was an evangelical, there were a couple of Catholics, a couple of Protestants, and a good number of the team never sort of revealed what their belief system was or what their faith might be. So there were probably some agnostics and some atheists in the group, remembering that this was a bunch of hardcore scientists, many of them in the nuclear weapons industry. And you know, some of them were deep in their faith, some were not. I remember Don Lynn, who was a member of our team from the Jet Propulsion Lab. Don, may rest in peace, was head of imaging on Voyager and Viking mm-hmm. and Mariner and Galileo.
He knew what he was doing.
I'm sorry?
He knew what he was doing.
Yeah, oh, yeah. He was my hero on the team. This is a NASA imaging scientist who ran some of the major imaging programs for NASA. And I remember Don saying to me a few days into it that the one thing, and he was Catholic, the one thing that impacted him, he said, was in looking at this tortured body and then the peaceful expression on the man's face, he said that contrast sort of stuck out to him. And so I think that each person experienced something emotional from their perspective, and mine was a lot more, I was more overwhelmed by being in this group of scientists,
Yeah. All
of them, you know, really preeminent in their field. And here I am, an old hippie photographer. Of course, I was a young hippie photographer in those days. But so I was just kind of overwhelmed by being in this group of people. And so for me, every moment of it was pretty exciting. You know, and at the same time, I recognized that we were doing something valuable and important to a lot of people on the planet.
There seems to be an incredible craze right now of stories that revolve around Jesus. We've got a movie coming out called Son of God.
Right.
People are hungry for stuff like that. There was a miniseries on the Bible. People were hungry for that. Why do you think that is, Barry?
Well, I think that, you know, as much as people say that their, you know, their faith is being attacked from all sides, I'm not sure that that's 100% accurate. Sure, there are people who are, you know, perhaps atheists and who don't like to, you know, hear about faith or people. But, you know, we live in a pretty troubled world. If you look at the news just today, there's major problems in major cities and in many different places around the world simultaneously. And I think that people look to faith sometimes to fill that void they may feel because of the things that are going on around us beyond our control, everything from, you know, the political situation in this country to, you know, things happening around the world that impact us all, to threats of terrorism. All of these things kind of give us, and I hate to say it, but, you know, a lot of the media plays on people's fears. We get that a lot. You hear that a lot from from all the different, I'm not selecting any particular one, but in general, and most of what's reported every day in the news is negative stuff, very little positive stuff, even though there are plenty of positive things happening in the world. You know, the Olympics are going on. We're number one on gold medals. That's a pretty positive thing. But
for now.
So much bad news is, you know, we get so much bad news shoved in our faces every day that it can be very depressing. And I think that people turn to faith when they feel that perhaps something lacking inside or some fear that they might be harboring. And I think that, turning to faith is a great thing to do if that's how one is disposed. And I think that, the fact that even Hollywood is beginning to acknowledge that this is something that can be mainstream. You know, Mel Gibson did it, and it created quite a furor, but it was a very successful film.
He did a good job.
Linda Downey and her husband, who produced the television series that you mentioned, The Bible, are the ones who also produced this film that's just coming out. And I saw a trailer just tonight for a new film coming out about Noah. So it seems that Hollywood is beginning to get the idea that maybe making films that have faith or faith-based kind of themes isn't something that is rejected by the public, but in fact welcomed and accepted. So I think that it's a good trend, and I think that, you know, anything that makes people look to God or look to whatever their spiritual guide might be, hopefully makes for a better world. So I see it as a good thing.
Tell me what happened in 1898 when Segundo Pia took the photograph of the cloth. What did we see with his negative?
Well, you know, ironically, until 1898, nobody had ever heard of the Shroud of Turin outside of northern Italy and perhaps southern France there.
And it was tucked away, wasn't it?
It was owned by the Savoy family, the ruling monarchy of Italy, for about 500 or 600 years. They had it, and they occasionally displayed it. They average about four times a century. So it was pretty quiet, and nobody much knew about it. And then in 1898, this Italian lawyer, Secondo Pia, who was he called himself an amateur photographer, but if you look at the giant camera he had to work with and the limited technology he had to work with, he was a pro in my mind. And what he did was, he was given permission to make the first photographic image of the Shroud of Turin. And when he did this, and he processed his glass plates that night, and he held the first glass plate up to the morning light when he opened the shutters, he was looking at a close-up of the face of the Shroud, and he wrote that he was looking into the face of the Lord and almost dropped the glass plate. And what he immediately discovered by looking at the glass plate, the negative image on his glass plate appeared more normal and natural than what's on the cloth itself. And he realized at that moment that the image on the Shroud has its lights and darks reversed like a photo negative. And when you make a photograph of that and reverse them again, you get a positive. And so that very famous black and white negative view of the Shroud as it appears on a photo negative, has become the iconic image, the one everybody's familiar with, the one that's most commonly used by the media when they mention the Shroud. And, of course, he announced publicly that the Shroud of Turin image had properties like a photographic negative. And he was immediately accused of fraud, and he was attacked.
Right, that's right.
And it's kind of sad, because it wasn't until 1931, when the Shroud was then photographed for the second time in its history by Giuseppe Henriet, who was a professional photographer. And Henriet came up with the same results that Pia, so it vindicated Pia, who was still alive. And at least before he died, he got to see his name cleared, because he was accused of manipulating it, manipulating the image, or doing something.
Hold on for a second, Barry. We want to come back. I want to talk about the photographs, and we'll get into the carbon dating fiasco. I'm George Norrie. Barry Schwartz was with us as we talk about the Shroud of Turin. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about some of these bankers who are dying. It's a weird, weird story, followed by the remote viewer, Ed Dames. Major Dames will talk to us about remote viewing, but also he lives partly in the Ukraine, in Kiev. He's got an apartment two blocks away from where most of this civil strife is occurring. We're going to talk with Ed about that as well, and what that means for the Ukraine area, Russia, and how it might affect us. We're going to come back in a moment with Barry Schwartz as we continue talking about what I still see as one of the most incredible stories ever, the Shroud of Turin. And welcome back with Barry Schwartz. Barry, let's get back into the photographs, if we can, for a minute. Then we'll get into the carbon dating. So the photographers who have taken these pictures, and you're one of them, of course, when you're looking at the shroud through the camera, and then you get this negative, this look, I mean, it's got to be goosebumpy for you, huh?
Well, you know, it is at the beginning. But remember that my involvement began about 37, 38 years ago. So I'm past the goosebump stage now, George, but you're right. At the beginning, when I came back with all the film, something like 100 rolls and several hundred sheets of film, and spent several days with the lab getting everything processed, you know, when you look at it and you realize that you've just had this great privilege to be in this room with this object that is significant to a lot of people out there, and you've just done something that no one's ever done before, yeah, it does bring on the goosebumps at that point in time. But again, as I said, I've had a lot of years to reflect on it now, and maybe I take it a little bit for granted because I understand it and I'm so familiar with it now. But certainly in the early days, it did. And the properties that the image has, which are truly unique, those are still pretty amazing because, you know, there have been countless efforts through especially in the last 30, 40 years, to duplicate the shroud by skeptics mostly, but trying to say, look, you know, here's a way that you can make an image that looks like the shroud. And many have successfully created images that sort of look like the shroud. But that's not the real test. We were able to characterize the chemistry and the physics of that image. We were able to determine that it did not have properties that any artwork would have. It has no paint or pigment there. It is not scorched into the cloth because there are many burns and scorches on the cloth from a fire back in 1532. And so we had many reference areas for scorching, but the color of the image and the color of scorches is very similar, especially to the naked eye. And so many people thought, well, maybe somebody took a metal statue and heated it up. One of our friends, you know, Joan Nichols, came up with that theory back in the 70s. And so, interestingly enough, heated linen that's been scorched, and as I say, we have plenty of references on the shroud for that, heated linen will fluoresce under UV fluorescence photography. And sure enough, all the scorches on the shroud fluoresced exactly and precisely the way we expected they would. The image, on the other hand, did not only not fluoresce, but it quenched the fluorescence of even the background of the cloth. So it was definitely not a product of high temperature, because high temperature causes scorches that we would have then detected. So what we were able to do is, even though we could not answer the question, how is the image formed, we've characterized it well enough so that when, even though we couldn't answer specifically, we were able to tell you what it's not a painting, not a photograph, not a scorch. So anytime somebody comes up with a mechanism that they believe might be responsible and they create an image, then we can apply the same test to their image that we applied to the shroud. And that's been done countless times, and no one has ever come even close to matching those chemical and physical properties. So the problem remains a mystery. And I often remind people, we live in the most modern image and the most image-oriented era of human history. Everybody's got a camera, a computer, can manipulate images, and yet no one has been able to duplicate the image on the shroud, not even the scientists who studied it. And to me, I mean, that doesn't prove anything other than the fact that it was not made by somebody in medieval times by any conventional methods, if modern science can't even figure it out or duplicate right. It. So, you know, I think those are pretty powerful arguments in favor of it being an authentic burial shroud.
All right, back to this latest report, of course, about the earthquake and what had happened. What they do say, though, is that it might have confused the carbon dating of the shroud, which suggested that the cloth was only 728 years old. And, of course, you believe it's authentic. It goes way, way back.
I believe it's older.
Yeah.
And there is evidence in the historical record that supports that. But as far as the radiation having some impact on carbon dating, that gets into an area of physics which is beyond my expertise, George, And I don't come on and pretend that I'm the smartest guy in the world.
I understand.
Perhaps it could have had some impact on carbon dating. Was it enough to skew the date, 1,300 years? Unlikely, according to the expert. But that's something that perhaps some further research and perhaps some future examination, if it's permitted, of the shroud, can help answer. So, ironically, you know, we went there to answer one question, came back with 1,000 new questions, and never really came back with an answer to the one question we were there to ask. But many of these new questions can be perhaps put to rest if new technology, remember it's 35, 36 years ago that we did this, the technology has improved so dramatically now. We can do full chemical analysis of the shroud without even touching it now with digital imaging spectroscopy and other types of spectral imaging. And so, to me, I think the reason that future research is still needed on the shroud is we answered some questions and came back with a lot more, but the newer technologies might allow us to put some of those questions to bed. But there's no indication at this moment in time that they're going to permit that anytime in the near future.
So let's go back to the death of Christ. And I kind of want you, based on what you think you know now with this, Barry, kind of paint us a picture of what happened. They take him down from the cross. What happens?
Well, before then even, let's go back to the day before.
All right.
When the evening before, he was beaten severely in the Garden of Gethsemane. If you look at the face of the man of the shroud, you can see both cheekbones are swollen, one more severely than the other. So he was already beaten about the face before they got to scourge and do the other things to him. Next day, of course, they scourged him with a Roman flagrum. And there are about 120 scourge marks visible on the shroud, front and back. And according to one of the forensic experts, the scourges were applied by two different men of different heights. They could tell by the angle, perhaps, of the scourge marks. Again, that's forensic experts that came up with that information. So we know that the man that's depicted on the cloth was beaten and was scourged. And then, of course, he was crucified. And we only see the back of the hand, so we see an exit wound closer to the wrist than the center of the palm, which makes sense from a forensic point of view. We see blood stains at the feet from the nail or nails that nailed his feet to the cross. We see blood stains all over the head as if from a cap or crown of thorns. And I always point out, look, it wasn't a pretty woven little crown like artists have depicted over the centuries. It was more like a thorn bush, and they just smashed it down on his head. They didn't have some Roman soldier weave a pretty crown for the supposed criminal they were about to execute. This man has bloodstains covering his head. He also has a large wound in his side. You can actually see the wound itself. According to the Gospels, Jesus was speared and was already dead and issued forth blood and water as it was stated in the Gospels. Probably clear fluid being pleural fluid from the lungs and blood from the body itself. We have a severe blood stain there. The densest blood stain on the shroud is from the spear wound. And ironically, with ultraviolet fluorescence photography, but not visible to the naked eye, is a serum stain. You know, the serum is the clear liquid portion of the blood. It separates by capillarity from the components of the blood, the blood cells. And there is a halo around many of the blood stains and even scourge wounds on the shroud, only visible with UV fluorescence photography. And that's the separation of the clear liquid portion of the blood from the blood cells themselves, the serum. So to see serum stains here, imagine this medieval forger for a moment, George. This guy says, okay, I'm going to hide this serum stain so that maybe in 700 years they'll figure a way to see it and see what I put there.
Well, yeah.
That's silly. You know, I mean, I'm being a little facetious, obviously. The point is simply this. There's just too much there. Look, they made a lot of relics in medieval times. That's one of the excuses used to sort of attack the shroud. But they were never as sophisticated or as complex. Why would somebody go through all that when just a simple, if you look at some of the replicas or copies made of the shroud, they're very crude paintings, and that was good enough for people to accept as real relics. So why would somebody need to go through all this? And let's face it, I mean, we can't even figure out how it's made ourselves, although we do know certain things that are really unique. For example, the lights and darks of the image of the Shroud of Turin are directly proportionate to the distance between the cloth and the body at the time the image formed. Well, that means where there was direct contact, top of the hands, tip of the nose, forehead, the image is darker. And as the distance, because, you know, the hands on the torso would lift the cloth away from the body itself, if you look at the hands of the man of the shroud, around those hands is kind of a halo where the cloth has been lifted further away from the body and there's less imaging. The imaging mechanism worked at a distance of up to about 4 centimeters and stopped. So the image just fades out as the distance increases. Well, what's interesting is now we can process that image either digitally or back in 77, we did it with an analog device called the VP8 image analyzer. It just takes the lights and darks of an image, input it with a black and white camera into the device, displays it on a green screen display like an oscilloscope type monitor, and it allows you to take the lights and darks of the image and turn them up vertically. And when you do that with a normal photograph, you get a jumble of shapes that are meaningless and have no kind of, they're not complete. They're just sort of a jumble. You take an image of the shroud and put it in this device, you get the natural relief of a human form. Uh-huh. That means that depth or topographic information is encoded into the density or the lights and darks of the image. Well, that's an amazing thing, George.
Oh, it's dramatic.
Can't do it with photography. Can't do it with art. It can only happen if there's some interaction between a cloth and a body. So that's one piece of evidence that's pretty convincing for me to say that, well, there had to be a man under this cloth at one point in its history.
Are we talking about an energy burst of a physical body that stayed there, or did it kind of like slowly just dissolve itself, disintegrate, like those little pictures in Star Trek when they're beamed aboard?
Yeah, you know, George, it's a great question that I don't think can be answered because, look, if you read the Gospels, it says there was a resurrection event, but it doesn't describe the event. So from a scientific point of view, we can speculate, but we don't have any kind of concrete scientific evidence to tell us what resurrection is. And I always tell people, because people often ask me a very blunt question, they say, well, doesn't the shroud prove the resurrection? And I say, well, if you're using the word proof, then I'd have to say no, because proof requires evidence. And although we have a lot of evidence about the shroud, we don't have much evidence about the resurrection. My answer is, until we can go into a laboratory and resurrect people to see what kind of images we can make, it's not really a test of science, but more a test of faith. And I think each person has to come to terms with that themselves.
This test of faith, Barry, let's assume that it is accurate, that it's correct, that the New Testament, everything in it was accurate. And let's assume that the Old Testament, Genesis, is accurate indeed. What does this do to mankind? I mean, because, you know, we're at a point right now where some people believe and some people don't. If this is all real, what does that tell you? What does it tell you about life after death? What does it tell you about the creation of the universe? What does it tell you about us?
Well, I think that, you know, again, coming from my perspective, not raised as a Christian, but raised in an Orthodox Jewish home, kind of like Fiddler on the Roof, so it's a slightly different background that I come from. But look, I see the shroud as something there for those who are interested. I always say that, you know, the shroud didn't come with a book of instructions. And I don't believe the answer to faith is necessarily on a piece of cloth, but it may well be in the eyes and hearts of those who look upon it. So I think I remind people, you know, in the Gospels, there was a man named Thomas who knew Jesus himself, and yet Thomas was, you know, had great doubts. So I think Jesus himself understood about doubt. And so I look at the shroud and say, okay, think about this, George, that what we know about the Shroud of Turin could not have been discovered until the second half of the 20th century. the technology didn't exist,
for
us to even begin to understand it.
That's right.
Until, you know, the second half of the 20th century. And so perhaps, considering the turmoil in the world, perhaps the shroud is there either to confirm people's faith or to restore people's faith in some cases, or just to assure them that their faith is, you know, is based on something that's real, because the shroud is tangible. It doesn't require someone to make that leap of faith. You can hold it in your hand. You can look at it. You can study it. And there aren't many things like that from the Old or New Testament that are so tangible that they can, you know, that we can actually have the opportunity to study them. So in the end, though, I think, and I say this on the website when I first built it 18 years ago, that given the facts, which is our job, which is to try and present you with all the facts that we have, given the facts, each person has to decide for himself what this means for them spiritually.
Sure.
But one thing I will say, it's a very powerful object, and I have seen people just looking at a replica of it, many people fall on their knees before it, and with tears streaming down their face because it's so meaningful to them. And yet I also see some people look at it, shrug their shoulders, and walk away, and it has no impact at all. So, George, it's for anybody who wants it, it's there. And for those who want to reject it, they can reject it. I always say, look, I'm not keeping score. I'm not trying to convince anybody. Each person has to figure that out for himself. Perhaps that's why we've been successful. We're not preaching anything. We're not affiliated with any specific religious denomination. We're very ecumenical. I lecture to Catholics, to Protestants, to evangelicals, to Messianic Jewish groups, or anybody who's interested in hearing about the Shroud of Turin. So I see that the interest is broadening out, and it's going beyond just the Catholic faith. I think a lot of Christians have somewhat of an anti-Catholic bias. The whole Protestant Reformation came from getting away from popes and relics. So I can understand that. But I see that there is an interest, and when people begin to understand and hear what we do know about it, and that, you know, that it doesn't go against Old or New Testament scriptures, I think a lot of people are opening up to it that in the past have sort of either completely ignored it or rejected it. And I'm seeing a change in people's minds now as they hear what we know about this. I think it comes to have more meaning for them. So, you know, I think, but in the end, though, George, you know, I can't get inside somebody's head and heart. They have to do that. And all I can do is say, look, here's the evidence, powerful enough, even though it took a long time to convince me, a non-Christian, that this is the real thing. And I think I've told you this before, but I'll mention it again. My now 91-year-old little Jewish mother, immigrant from Poland at age 7 through Ellis Island, high school education, heard one of my lectures, and afterwards she was very quiet. You know, when a Jewish mother's quiet, George, be afraid. And she was very quiet. We were driving back after she heard my lecture, first time she'd ever heard one in person. And so I turned to her and I said, Mother, what do you think? And she said, well, of course, it's authentic. So I'm shocked this little old Jewish lady is telling me the Shroud of Turin is authentic. I said, so what makes you say that? And then she kind of got Jewish mother on me. She said, Barry, they wouldn't have kept it for 2,000 years if it belonged to anybody else. Nobody cared. So it had to belong to Jesus. And I laughed and I thought, how cute. Until I thought about it and I realized that's a very profound observation. This is a burial shroud, George. They usually go in the tomb with the body and decay with the body. And that's why we don't have intact burial shrouds to compare the shroud to, because most bodies go into the grave along with their burial shroud. Both are organic. Both decompose over time. The Shroud of Turin somehow got separated from the dead body it's covered.
We're going to come back already at the top of the hour. We're going to open up the phone lines for you right here on Coast to Coast AM.